The Bitcoin Standard Toolkit is a selection of Bitcoin services I recommend to my readers and learners on SaferDean.com as they upgrade their monetary operating system from the fiat standard to the Bitcoin standard. These companies are NYDIG, a leading full-service financial services firm dedicated to Bitcoin, applying institutional wisdom and ingenuity to help clients access the unrealized potential of this emerging asset class. NYDIG offers the full suite of solutions needed for financial institutions to access Bitcoin, including custody, execution, financing, treasury solutions, integration partnerships, and more. The team behind NYDIG brings decades of experience in the financial markets and passion for sound money to help provide the rails that will bring about a move to the Bitcoin standard. I have been working as a consultant for NYDIG for 2 years now, and I'm very impressed with their vision, focus, and execution. Go to NYDIG.com to learn more. CipherSafe. To secure your Bitcoins, it is important to keep your seed phrase backed up safely, and for that, I highly recommend using the CipherWheel Seed Storage Device, a gorgeous and brilliant sturdy piece of low-time preference engineering from a fourth-generation machine shop in Maine. The Cypher Wheel is machined from solid stainless steel, and its unique and elegant design is inspired by secret decoder rings, as well as legendary mechanical engineer Franz Rouleau and the golden age of machine design. If you've read the Bitcoin Standard, you'll know I think the late 19th century was a golden age for many facets of human advancement because of hard money. Bitcoin is bringing hard money back, and our friends at CypherSafe are giving Bitcoin the low time preference machines it deserves from the golden age of design. Go to CypherSafe.io to get the Cypher Wheel for your Bitcoins. OKCoin. Whenever someone asks me how to invest in Bitcoin, my advice is to accumulate Bitcoins periodically for the long run, or what is called dollar cost averaging. When you buy every day, week, or month, you channel Bitcoin's volatility to your advantage. In the long run, this strategy will outperform every other Bitcoin investment strategy, probably, except for amazing luck, perhaps. The best place to do recurring purchases is OKCoin because they have the lowest fees for recurring Bitcoin purchases you will find anywhere. If you're stacking sats for the long run, every sat matters, and the fees with each purchase will add up. That's why I recommend you buy at the lowest cost possible from OKCoin. OKCoin is also the Bitcoin exchange available in the most countries around the world, so it will hopefully be accessible for you wherever you are. Go to OKCoin.com to get started with your stacking. Nodal 1. As discussed in the Bitcoin Standard, Bitcoin is controlled by the nodes that operate its software. It is only through consensus between nodes that the Bitcoin blockchain continues to live, and it is only by running a Bitcoin node that you are part of this consensus and can verify the validity of the transactions you receive and the ownership of your coins. Whenever anyone asks me what are the most important warning signs that something is wrong with Bitcoin, I always answer the following. If the number of Bitcoin nodes is declining, and or the cost of running a node is rising significantly. I believe it is really important to run a node, but I don't recommend running it on your work or personal computer as it can compromise the performance of your computer and, more importantly, the security and privacy of your Bitcoin node. A far better solution is to buy a dedicated hardware node, and for that, I highly recommend Nodal. Manage all your Bitcoin activity, such as Lightning or BTC Pay server, and isolate them from your personal computer by putting them into one dedicated device that is always running and does one thing only, Bitcoin. Become a first-class Bitcoin citizen by running your own Nodal node, available at nodal.it, and that's spelled N-O-D-L.it. Finally, Cold Card. My hardware wallet of choice is the Cold Card. I strongly recommend only conducting Bitcoin trades on computers that are dedicated to Bitcoin and cannot connect to the internet. I like the Cold Card because it is a contained machine optimized for Bitcoin and Bitcoin only. Cold Card is basically a small computer that can only do Bitcoin, which makes securing it more straightforward. Use the code BitcoinStandard on coldcardwallet.com to get a 5% discount. Hello and welcome to another episode of the Bitcoin Standard Podcast Seminar. Today's guest is an anonymous person who is around the Bitcoin scene and has been for a while and has produced some very interesting work. Some of you may know him on Twitter. His handle is DerGigi. And Gigi is a blogger and a software engineer. Before getting into Bitcoin, he used to be a full-time software developer. And he's written 21 lessons, what I've learned from falling down the Bitcoin rabbit hole. He's also launched several Bitcoin-related projects, such as BitcoinResources.com, BitcoinQuotes.com, and the German podcast with a long German name that I'm not going to butcher and pronounce and make myself into a joke. So Gigi, thank you so much for joining us.
Hello, Saif. Thanks so much for having me.
All right. So first of all, I want to talk about your work and on Bitcoin and all. We're going to get to all of that. But I guess before that, could you tell us a little bit more about the person behind the Twitter account without doxing yourself too much, perhaps?
Of course. So yeah, I'm from Austria. So Austrian now through and through. And I discovered Bitcoin quite late, actually. My first contact was kind of early. So I studied computer science and I've been in software basically for the last 15 plus years. And some of my software and computer science friends, they discovered Bitcoin, but they didn't really understand the gravity of it. And I dismissed it for the first couple of years. So it took me a very, very long time to take a second and a third look. And once I started to realize that this is actually an important thing, I fell further and further down the rabbit hole. And I, as you mentioned, ended up writing 21 lessons because I felt the things that I learned, they were kind of important and I wanted to, I just had to share it with with the world and the people. And yeah, so this is my background. I choose to stay kind of anonymous or pseudonymous because I think privacy is important online. And I want to kind of also showcase to people that it's actually possible to stay more hidden than the regular person that broadcasts everything on Facebook. So I worked in the software industry related to non-privacy technology. So I worked in the passport industry and wrote software for border crossing checks, stuff like that. And so this is in part why this is very important to me, because I think we have to regain our privacy as well.
Yes, fantastic. So your background was in software engineering. You weren't into Austrian economics, even though you're an Austrian, right?
Exactly. I had no idea about economics. I never heard about Austrian economics. I knew the tech side of Bitcoin very well. So I knew what, you know, like I knew my cryptography, I knew my computer science. I knew what a hash was. I knew what public key cryptography was and so on and so forth. But I was missing that Bitcoin. Like the biggest puzzle piece that I was missing was that Bitcoin is actually money, and I had no idea what money was. So it took me several years to catch up to you guys, you know, and the Bitzines and the Piero Shards of the world. And I'm glad I discovered this world, and I'm very happy that I, you know, have a more profound understanding of money than I had before.
Yeah, it always struck me that Austrians seem to know very little about Austrian economics. I've been to Austria and I've known a lot of Austrians over the years. And every time I mention them, they look at me like I'm just somebody who's weird. Well, to be fair, I am a bit weird to be talking about Austrian economics to random Austrians I meet. But they think I'm much weirder than I actually am. And it's just, you know, what do you mean there's an Austrian economics? Like, we're just another country when we have the same economics as all other countries. And there's very little knowledge of Hayek and Mises. I know there's a Hayek Street in Vienna, but it's a pretty tiny street somewhere, pretty obscure. It's not very, he's not very well known, which is kind of sad. But you know, it's not something that is, Austrian economics is not really relevant to Austria in any particular way. So it's as sad as it is anywhere else, I guess.
Yeah, that's true. And I, to be fair, I think, you know, thanks to Bitcoin, there is now a renewed interest. And the German podcast that I helped launch is called 21, which is just the German word for 21. So it's not as complicated as, but okay, to be fair, every German word is kind of complicated and long. But the community around the podcast in the German speaking world, of course, everyone has to learn their Austrian economics now. And there are a lot of people in Germany and Switzerland and Austria, like there are thousands of people now that are actually reading Mises and Hayek and Rothbard and so on and so forth. And it's all thanks to Bitcoin. So that is quite beautiful that there's a renewed interest because of the Orange Coin.
Yeah. So tell us, you know, in your book, 21 Lessons, what are the most important lessons or the ones that you think are most relevant to this seminar and this audience? I presume, you know, the lessons you learned about Austrian economics, as somebody who just came in new, what did you find most interesting?
Yeah, I think learning about money and the history of money was definitely very interesting. But I think, and especially in what we want to talk about, I think lesson one is actually the most important one. And lesson one is that you don't change Bitcoin, but Bitcoin will change you. So it is this, you know, like it is the unmovable object. So no matter how hard you try to change Bitcoin, you have to align with Bitcoin and with the values and properties kind of embedded in it. And I felt this firsthand. So I was very opposed to Bitcoin, I would say, just from my previous worldview, did not align with Bitcoin. And so I had to burn off a lot of myself and change my views quite drastically to align myself with Bitcoin. And of course, I would say it was for the better, because there is a certain kind of truth embedded in Bitcoin, and just wrestling with the truth, it will humble you over and over again, and it will change you in the process.
Yeah, I think it's one way that I like to think about it is that each Bitcoin block is a global reality check, where everybody in the world who deals with Bitcoin has to come to consensus on the terms of Bitcoin every 10 minutes. It's like everybody around the world has to bend the knee to the Bitcoin protocol and say, yes, I agree to these consensus rules. Please keep my coins. Don't take away my coins. And it's just, it's an incredible exercise in humility, in a sense. Like, if you're operating Bitcoin, because, you know, you're part of this thing. And every time you think, all right, maybe let me change it. You know, any other avenue of the world, say you're part of a bank, or you're part of a political organization, or you're part of a sports team or whatever, you see something you don't like, and, you know, you immediately think, hey, I can fix this. I'm going to make this better. I'm smart. And then you proceed to try and fix it. And then, you know, you run into conflict with others, or maybe you succeed, maybe you fail. But Bitcoin is just out of this world, in that it just sits there and it doesn't care. And, you know, every 10 minutes, you need to bend the knee to the current consensus protocol parameters. And you essentially learn to be humble, I think, from that, because you can't change it, but you can benefit enormously from just playing along with it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, as you also wrote in the Bitcoin standard, it is best understood as like a force of nature. You know, it is like the sun is rising and Bitcoin blocks will continue to come in. That's the way to understand it. And that's why it's so humbling, because nature is humbling as well. You know, like if you ever learn to surf or anything like that, the ocean will humble you. And the same is true for Bitcoin. It's very relentless, and it won't stop, and it won't change for you. And I think that's why, like, a lot of people in the tech world and in the software world, they just fail to understand this aspect, because they think it's just software and you can change software and you can launch your own version and so on and so forth. But what those people fail to understand is that changing Bitcoin is not an exercise in software engineering. It's a social exercise. You have to convince everyone who is running a fully validating node to adopt your new rules. If you want to change the rules of Bitcoin, it's not an engineering task. It's very, very different. And just because we have, you know, this intransigent minority of toxic maximalists that just will not change the 21 million, no matter what kind of cookies you try to give them, it's a very, very hard task. And a lot of people have failed, as we've seen in the fork wars. And I think people will just continue to fail. And this is also why I think Bitcoin will continue to change people in part, you know, because it is unchangeable, you kind of have to align with it. And of course, you know, as you well know, there's also the lowering of time preference. And I believe a large part of it is also the adoption of responsibility that you kind of have to take on if you want to use Bitcoin properly.
Yeah, I think, you know, to stick to the immutability issue, it's something that I keep thinking about, and I'm not sure I have a set answer on whether it's really the software and the nature of the network that makes it immutable, or if it actually is the intransigent community. Because I go back and forth about this, because yes, there's a lot of loud people on Twitter who will make fun of you and destroy you, basically, if you try and mess with their magic internet money. But I think there's a good case to be made that the only reason that they can do this, that they can discuss this in that way, that they can afford to remain intransigent, is because of the network. But then again, you know, you look at the other altcoins, whether you look at the altcoins, and you see it's very easy for them to be changing. And I think it might be just the self-selection process that happened with Bitcoin and shitcoins, wherein if you understood that, 21 million is enough for everybody, and then anybody who's going to make another extra shitcoin is essentially engaging in inflation, you're a different kind of person from the person who says, oh, wow, shiny new money. Let me make my own, or let's find where the next one is going to be. It's a different thought process. Like, and obviously I'm biased here, but I think it's a much deeper thought process when you understand, whoa, this thing only works because there's this fixed number of Bitcoin and we have this scarcity that is attached to it and nobody can change the supply. And so the value here is that we have one neutral monetary protocol. And so if you don't see the neutrality of the protocol, then you think, all right, well, let me make my own shitcoin. And then you think that that's going to be equivalent to it. But that's a very superficial understanding of it. And I think it selects for the people who get it, which is, oh, wait, there's only going to be 21 million. I better get as many as I can and try and see how this thing works and learn how to do it. So it's interesting. What do you think?
Yeah, I think Bitcoin definitely self-selects, and I think we saw this also in the early waves. You know, it selected for the craziest people first, kind of. You know, you had to be deep into crypto anarchy, kind of, to and the cypherpunk to be on board in the first couple of weeks or months. And I think it continues to self-select, and I think it still selects on kind of the extreme personality traits. I believe the last couple of years you had to be very disagreeable to get into Bitcoin, because it's just such an alien technology and it's so far removed from the mainstream understanding of things that you had to kind of be willing to say fuck you to everyone else and just get into Bitcoin. And I think you also have to be very, very open to new ideas to think that, you know, this funny internet money can rule the world.
Yeah.
But I also think you mentioned shitcoins versus Bitcoin. And I think there is a huge, huge difference between all these communities. And I think, you know, Bitcoiners in general, as you mentioned, they understand that this is Bitcoin was introduced as kind of a gift to the world to fix all kinds of issues and to enrich humanity. And shitcoins are introduced to enrich a small group of people. That's true for every single shitcoin. And it's just the groups of people that are different. But Bitcoin is truly the only project that had this immaculate conception and came out of nowhere and monetized spontaneously and had no pre-mine or anything like that. And I think the big difference now is Bitcoiners in general, they want to eliminate senior edge, and shitcoiners just want to be the ones who are printing money. I think that's the biggest difference.
Yeah, I've tweeted this one before. Somebody was saying something, you know, usually there's the shitcoiner who's going, you know, we're all fighting on the same team and we're all together and we shouldn't be negative to each other and we should all, sing kumbaya together as we bring this new world of digital decentralization. No, we're not here to do decentralization. Like, I don't care about decentralization as a goal itself. I'm very happy with all kinds of centralized things that I use. Most everything that I use is centralized, and it's going to remain centralized. And that's just the division of labor. So decentralization is a tool that you use in certain contexts, and the end goal is not to make this thing decentralized. The end goal is to end seniorage. And that's ultimately what it comes down to. Shitcoiners just think, let's give everyone seniorage, as if that could work. It's kind of Keynesian thinking. You know, if everybody could print their own currency, or if every company, or if every neighborhood, or if every country or city could print its own currency, then everybody can be the Fed. Everybody can be Goldman Sachs. Everybody can win from the Cantillon effect. And you know, it's going to be a while until people learn this lesson, but eventually if everyone can print their money, then nobody can. That's really the solution to it. In fact, you know, Hayek and Rothbard, I think both of them used to say that all that we want In separate contexts, they both mentioned is that all that they call for is simply not letting the government have special privileges in terms of money. Whatever the government can do, others can do. And if others can do the same thing, then, you know, if everybody can print their own currency, then soon enough we'll realize why everybody chooses the harder money. So it takes a lot to get that. And I think it's interesting what you said about the open-mindedness. There's the people conflate open-mindedness with being easily influenced or easily impressionable or gullible. You know, if you're open-minded, then you have to listen to everybody. And Bitcoiners, I think, strike this balance perfectly, which is you're open to new ideas, but you're not open to getting gaslighted into believing into stupid bullshit because people are emotionally manipulating you, which is essentially the pitch for all shit coins, including fiat coins. You know, ultimately, fiat coins come down to nationalism as well as idiotic Keynesian virtue signaling about helping the workers and the children and all of that stuff. And it takes a very good balance where you're open to considering the possibility that this magic internet money that seems like a very stupid thing because it's weird, that might actually be real. And yet at the same time, you know, you're willing to tolerate friends and family and all sorts of people telling you you're an idiot and you're crazy and you're a scammer and you're a Ponzi schemer. And to have the clarity and the strength of mind to be able to put that beside you. And, you know, it's easy to think that, you know, you're not influenced by others, but you're very influenced by others. And I think if you look back, you'll see that a lot of your actions were influenced by the people that you're interacting with. And it takes a lot of consciousness of it in order to be able to overcome it. So it's definitely a self-selecting bunch. I agree with you on that one.
Yeah, and I think it also still selects for engineers. And I think it has to do with what you've said about open-mindedness. And you need kind of what keeps you in check and what keeps a good engineer in check is reality itself. You know, you build something, and if the bridge still stands after 100 years, you're a good engineer. If it falls down after 10 days, you're a bad engineer. And I think engineers kind of internalize that there is a base reality and you can find out how things work and there is truth. There's truth to be found. And I think if you study Bitcoin from first principles, it becomes kind of self-evident that this thing cannot be killed. You know, Bitcoin maximizes for survival. And you can call it decentralization because that's basically the same thing in this context. You know, it's if it's maximally decentralized, only one node, if only one node survives the nuclear holocaust, we're still good to go. We're good to go. If we have one copy of the ledger, one copy of the source code, we're good to go. We can start where Satoshi started. And of course, you know, the only thing that you can't copy in Bitcoin is the difficulty. So difficulty will remain high and we will have to find some miners to crunch the numbers. But I think that's where engineers kind of have a benefit because it's definitely possible to understand Bitcoin from the ground up, from first principles. And then you just land at the point where you understand that Bitcoin is so insanely resilient and so secure and so strong and just this impenetrable fortress of validation, as has been said before, that there is just, you will have to live with it. You know, there is no way to outlaw it because Bitcoin is just thought and speech. You know, I can store 12 words in my head and I can receive Bitcoin, no problem. It's just thoughts and math. That's all it is. And it's very hard to outlaw this. And again, you know, the law only works if you can enforce it. And so if you can't enforce it, tell me how to enforce, how to outlaw me having 12 words in my head. That's very difficult. So you will have to live with Bitcoin and Bitcoin won't go away.
Yeah, I definitely agree on the engineers. I studied engineering myself in undergraduate and it was mechanical engineering. I did learn a little bit of software engineering, but I'm not a software engineer. And a lot of Bitcoiners, and I think particularly toxic maximalists, come at Bitcoin from an engineering background. Just off the top of my head, I know Michael Saylor, Lynn Alden, and I think there's a similar kind of framework of thinking about things. And what you said about the bridge is exactly it. It's you know, the bridge either stands or it falls. And if it falls, nobody cares about all of your excuses. You know, they didn't give me the metal that I asked for, or that shipment was late and I had to make do with something else. None of that counts. The bridge has to stand. And so there's a very, very real sense of truth. And this is why, you know, you can get philosophical about truth and subjectivity and reality and relativism and all of that stuff. But ultimately, if you want to do anything with your life more than just, you know, remain in the same puddle of blood where your mom birthed you until you die, if you want to do anything, you know, you need to understand reality with certain in certain, you know, clear, concrete terms. You know, you want to figure out how to get out of bed without falling and hurting yourself. And there's a way to do that. And there are wrong ways of doing that. And, you know, people just get tired, I think, from the thought processes that go into more complex things. And then they get thrown off and then they start thinking all these kind of ridiculous philosophical questions about, well, what if truth is not true and how do we know and what? Well, that's very nice. But, you know, if you'd like to eat and excrement and, you know, manage to do those two things separate from each other without them mixing with each other so that you could survive for a few more days so that you could stay alive, there's an objective reality you can deal with. And, you know, you do things right and then things will work. You build the house properly. It'll keep you safe in the winter. And, you know, Bitcoin is like that. It's just an extension of smart, productive engineering applied to the question of money. It's by far the most astonishing, I think, technology ever made for money. And if you think of things practically like an engineer with a clear understanding of truth, I think it's hard not to be awed by it. And I think I would guess you're far more likely to find, I think if you were to measure percentages, you'd probably find more engineers among Bitcoiners than among shitcoiners because of just, you know, truth and reality.
Yeah, I would definitely agree. And I think it's just also different kind of people because of different kind of priorities and worldviews. And in general, you know, in Silicon Valley, there's still this move fast and break things mentality. And you just cannot do this in Bitcoin. You must not do this in Bitcoin. Like every engineer in Bitcoin knows and agrees that, first of all, the backwards compatibility is of utmost importance. Like you must not hard fork, period. You know, like it's that's the whole value proposition of Bitcoin is that this thing will live for the next couple thousand years. And so this is also where the low time preference comes into play. You know, like we want to build structures that last for a very, very long time. And building structures in cyberspace that last for a very long time is really hard. And so you need, I think also here, Bitcoin self-selects for the best and most careful engineers and for the most capable cryptographers. And we see this all the time. You know, other networks go down. If your network goes down, it's not a network. It's not a decentralized network. It's a server. You know, if your network can be paused, it's not a network. If your network can go bankrupt because the company behind it goes bankrupt, it's not a decentralized network. So all of those projects are a joke compared to Bitcoin. And if you just look at the track record, and especially if you look at the difficulty, everything else doesn't even register. Everything else pales in comparison completely. Like I hate price charts. I don't look at price charts at all. I stopped doing that a long time ago, but I still look at hash rate charts from time to time. And it's just absolutely insane how high the hash rate is for Bitcoin and nothing else even registers, you know, like, and I think those are the metrics that count. You know, you want to look at security, you want to look at stability, you want to look at uptime, you want to look at critical bugs and things like that. You know, the nobody ever lost Bitcoin because of Bitcoin, the network. You know, like you only lose Bitcoin because of user errors. You only lose Bitcoin because you leave it at some exchange to get hacked or you get hacked. Or most people, I think, lose Bitcoin because they they forget the password or lose the seed phrases and stuff like that.
Absolutely. I think, you know, a lot of people like to, one of the dumbest memes going around in the crypto sphere is the idea that, well, Bitcoin's old and decrepit and sclerotic, while, you know, all the innovation and smart engineering is taking place on all these shitcoin scam networks like Bitcoinet, Connect and Ethereum or whatever they're called. And I think that's absolutely hilarious because, you know, these networks very clearly cannot even keep themselves up and running. And we've seen them get hacked in the most hilarious ways. And I think, you know, in particular, for instance, you could think about Ethereum when the DAO hack happened. I think the real hack was not the DAO hack. I think the real hack was the reaction to the DAO hack. Yeah. I think the real failure of the Ethereum system was not that people managed to take money from the stupid smart contract, which happens every week, or if not every day, because all of this code is just high time preference people trying to find new stories for explaining why they're moving around their fake ledger entry coins from one centralized ledger to the other. And if you can manage to break that and then lead to the system moving to hard fork the blockchain, then you've invalidated the entire use case for the blockchain. And of course, it continues to survive because there's a lot of easy, stupid money around, and because there's a lot of hype and a lot of marketing, and it piggybacks on Bitcoin, and it piggybacks on the bias that people have that if there's a Bitcoin, then there must be a, you know, another one, just like if there's a Burger King, there must be a McDonald's. But, you know, in terms of engineering, I think it's incomparable. And I think time preference is a great great way of explaining it. If we see this happen over and over again, you know, people just come into shitcoins with some strange idea. And then they think, yeah, I'm just going to do this with a shitcoin and that's going to work. And then it doesn't work. And they expect that the simple idea that they came up with, which is 80% or 90% Bitcoin, and then adding some irrelevant bells and whistles that just add security weaknesses, they expect that to be as functional as Bitcoin. You know, they want their blockchain out there competing with Bitcoin when it's been really four guys who looked at the code before it was launched. And, you know, with predictably hilarious consequences, as always.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think the lowering of time preference definitely plays a role. As we said, you want to build solid structures that last a long time into the future. And I think most people that are gambling on the shitcoin casinos and have been launching ICOs and other projects, they just want to maximize their US dollar gains in a short period of time. So it's basically all just gambling and cashing out, in my opinion. I also agree with you that the DAO reversal was way worse than the DAO hack, because that's what for me drove the nail into the coffin of this project, because, you know, it was code is law, and then oh no, if the code doesn't do what we want, then it's us five people that make the law. And so what are we even doing, you know, like doing things in a decentralized way is way 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 more difficult and way less efficient than doing it just on one server and one Excel sheet. And basically if you can change the rules, what are you even doing? And
exactly,
I think what also most people fail to realize is that in the end, everything comes down to decentralization in Bitcoin. You know, like that's why Bitcoiners run their own nodes. That's why you have to hold your own keys, not your keys, not your Bitcoin. Like those sayings don't, like they all exist for a reason, because if we fail to keep the decentralization alive, then Bitcoin, I think, will be a failed project in the long run, because it will run into a situation where you have one masternode and then it's very easy to change the rules. So it is all interconnected and interrelated. And I think that's also a big, big difference to every other project, because every other project, you know, has like 50 nodes on AWS. Nobody runs their own whatever node at home. You know, there are no Raspberry Pis running any other project. So it just doesn't exist.
And the competition for these kind of dApps, decentralized apps, that competition for them is AWS. And AWS is about a millionth cheaper than using these decentralized networks, for a very good reason. For the same reason that I discussed in the Bitcoin standard, why a Bitcoin transaction is more expensive than a second layer transaction. You know, if you're just willing to trust in somebody, you can run 14 billion, what was it? I think 2 billion transactions a day on a laptop or something like that. I forget the exact numbers, but, you know, to do some Elon Musk level engineering, you know, you can 10x everything if you just run it on your own laptop. But then good luck with the security of it. And that's really ultimately what compromises the model. But enough about shitcoins. We're not here to talk about shitcoins. Who cares? We're here to talk about time and time preference. So one really powerful idea that you've introduced in a brilliant article is called Bitcoin is time. And I think that's a very powerful way of thinking about it. So why is Bitcoin time?
Yeah, I actually took the other side of the coin. I'm not talking about time preference in this article. I'm talking about literal time, and the problem that Bitcoin solved is the problem of time stamping. And there was no way to tell the time in a decentralized network without relying on a central clock. And so this was what let all other projects before Bitcoin fail. I mean, there were a lot of attempts to do something like Bitcoin before Bitcoin, and they all relied on one form of a centralized server or another. And since we are talking about ledgers, you only can do ledgers in the digital space. There are no tokens in the digital space, no matter how many shitcoin people will convince you that there are tokens. Token is a complete misnomer. You only have data, and data is basically a ledger, always. You know, like there are only data entries, there are only ledger entries. That's the only way you can do money in an informational substrate. It's, you know, I really like what NBK said once. He said, in Bitcoin, the map is the territory. And that is so true. Like, I'm not even sure if he knows how insanely true that is. Because with every other list, if you make a list of things, if you move from the real world into the informational realm, the map is never the territory. You will always have the disconnect between the real world, the physical world, and the thing that you put on the list. And this is a huge, huge, huge problem. And this is basically the Oracle problem. And this is also true for time. That's why in every other system, you can always do timing attacks. You know, you can just rewind your clocks or say it's in the future, and you can modify your timestamps, and then your whole system doesn't work because everyone in a decentralized system is supposed to play nice, right? So all the timestamps have to match up, and if there are large discrepancies, then the system can't handle it. And that's why Bitcoin introduced its own notion of time, which is the time chain. And I hate the term blockchain for many reasons, but I also hate it because, you know, like there's the famous saying of blockchain. What is a blockchain? It's a chain of blocks, so it's completely meaningless. But if you call it a time chain, it becomes insanely obvious that it has to do with time. And this is actually, you know, what Bitcoin's internal time is based on is the block height. It is tick, tick, tick. Every 10 minutes, the next block comes in. And the only anchor to the real world is the difficulty adjustment, which kind of, with a moving window, adjusts the difficulty in a way so that we match 10 minutes of human time. And this solves so many problems at once. It solves, as you know, the issuance problem. And that's why we know when the last Bitcoin is going to be mined approximately. But another thing that Nick Szabo, you know, like he hit his head against the wall for about 10 years to solve this problem. And it's about coming up with an algorithm that is stable in terms of computation. So cryptanalytic stability. So if you come up with a computer problem, you want to have unforgeable costliness when it comes to money. So you want to have something that is hard for computers to do, so you can have something like a digital coin. The problem is computers get faster and faster and faster all the time. So if you mine a digital coin, you know, 15 years ago, then it's completely worthless because your birthday card, the chip in your happy birthday card, can mine it for you, you know, like 15 years later. And this always was a problem. And this is also the beauty of the difficulty adjustment, that it takes into account that more people are going to mine, and that computers are going to get faster, and that we're going to have graphics cards and ASICs and all that jazz. And so it solves so many problems at once. And I think viewing proof of work and Bitcoin through the lens of time, and just realizing that it is actually a decentralized clock, it will help you to understand how profound the invention of Bitcoin is. Because you can dismiss every other idea outright, because every other idea, like proof of stake or proof of space or what have you, you know, there are many really stupid ideas in shitcoin land that want to solve similar problems in a different way, and it just doesn't work, period. It doesn't work from first principles. You can always do timing attacks, and you have no way of telling a decentralized time. And it's even more tricky than that because of relativity. we don't have a fixed time on Earth in the first place. Synchronizing clocks across Earth is an impossible problem. The light radius of Earth is 50 milliseconds. If you would enlarge it, then it would become more obvious. But you cannot. There is no simultaneous, like there are no simultaneous events on Earth. You know, like it's a difficult concept if you're not well versed in physics and relativity, but it's true nonetheless. That's why, you know, we have to update the timestamps of GPS satellites all the time, because they are fighting this problem. It's really, really hard. It's impossible to have a common time across space. And this is what Bitcoin solves. And it solves it in like this beautiful probabilistic manner. And all those things, they run very, very deep. And most people, especially most, you know, like JavaScript programmers, they don't realize how profound the problems are that Bitcoin solves.
Yeah, I think this is a great example of what we were mentioning earlier in terms of the differences in the engineering mentality. All of these proof of buzzword programs that you see in shitcoin land, it's the exact example of bad engineering, where you start not with a problem that you're looking to solve, but you're trying to find a solution that looks in a certain way. So, you know, the problem has been solved by Bitcoin, but it offends your silly brainwashed sensibilities that Bitcoin uses electricity, because you've spent the last 30 years consuming stupid television and university press releases telling you that electricity is bad because electricity is making the world, the earth burn down, and we're turning the planet into a hellhole, and we're killing the polar bears because we're using electricity. And so, you know, it's nonsensical to just approach, all right, we solved this problem, but how do we do it in a way that allows me to virtue signal in the way that I like?
It's very similar to cargo cooled engineering, if you know the term. It's like, yeah, you see the World War planes land, and they bring all the nice cargo and they bring all the supplies, and one day they leave and they never come back. And so you think you know what you're doing, and you're building an airstrip and something that approximates a microphone and headphones and some antennas and a tower, so that the planes, you want to make the planes land, and you build your own planes out of bamboo, and they just don't fly and nothing happens. And it's just because you don't understand the engineering and the problems in the first place. You don't even understand what you're trying to solve. And I think a lot of people that want to do proof of anything but work, they don't understand what Bitcoin solves in the first place. And it's decentralized timestamping. It's Bitcoin is a decentralized clock. And if you don't solve this problem, there is no other way to solve it. Like, I'm convinced of that. I'm convinced of that because in the realm of information, if you're dealing with a ledger, if you're dealing just with pure information, all you have is the transformation of this information. You have nothing else. You only have computation. And computation requires energy. And that's one of the axioms that Bitcoin is built upon. If computation would not require energy, Bitcoin would not work. If we would find a way to do computation without using any energy, the security model of Bitcoin would break down. And so I'm convinced that proof of work is the only thing that works to do decentralized timestamping. And that's why I dismiss everything else outright. And I understand the other systems quite well. I think my understanding of them is above average when it comes to Bitcoin, because I studied them for a very long time. And I thought there was another way. You know, I thought about this very deeply for many years. And I came to the conclusion, there is no other way. Like, you have to use energy, because all we have is information, and all we have is the transformation of information, which is computation.
Yeah, I think a useful metaphor here to tell people is that it's not that proof of work is one way to reach a destination. It's more like proof of work is the right key for this exact lock that we're looking to unlock. And so this is what we're trying to achieve. We're trying to find a way where we can have decentralized timestamping, where we can make the quantity of issuance and the consensus parameters independent of the computing power, where the thing readjusts always regardless of the computing power. So the problem pertains specifically to computing power and to energy consumption. So the solution has to be at that. You know, this is what the lock looks like. And so the key has to look exactly like the lock in order for the lock to turn. That's just how it is. And so, you know, trying to arrive at is cargo cult engineering for the lock. Yeah. You know, if we just get a bunch of sticks and stones and put them into the lock, maybe it'll open. No, yeah, you need the exact key, and the exact key has to attack the problem from where it is, which is as you very well explained, you know, the time and the energy component.
Yeah. And the beautiful thing is that all you need is time. You know, Bitcoin doesn't know about the energy. Bitcoin, like, it's only by a probabilistic nature that it knows about. But what Bitcoin does, it really adjusts only for time. So if more Bitcoiners mine, they're going to be faster. And then you have to adjust the difficulty. So you're going to hit the 10-minute window again. All it cares about is just adjusting the average that it takes to mine a new block. Up or down to 10 minutes. That's all it cares about. And you solve all the issues just with that. Because if computers get faster and faster and faster and faster, it doesn't matter. You just make it harder to mine. And you also solve the issuance problem. So it's such a beautifully engineered Gordian knot. And if you remove just one thing out of Bitcoin, it all falls apart. So it's a very minimal solution, but it's such a beautiful solution and it solves like three impossible problems.
Yeah, and in an engineering perspective, I think it's really bringing to the digital realm what gold solves in that problem in the physical realm. You know, the reason gold continued to be money through thousands of years is not because it solved the proof of stake problem or the proof of space problem or the proof of whatever shitcoin buzzword is going on these days. It's because it solved the proof of work problem. That's the problem that existed with money in the physical realm, and it exists with money in the digital realm. And so gold's proof of work required you to find the rarest occurring animal element in Earth. And it required a lot of cost to refine it and turn it into a monetary medium. And it meant that, you know, because of the fact that the thing was incorruptible, because gold didn't ruin or rust or corrode or dissolve, it meant that we were constantly stacking up a stockpile of gold so that new gold production, you know, the faster we produced gold, the bigger the stockpile became, and therefore the smaller the new production was in relation to the existing stockpile. So therefore, ensuring that we're always not being inflationary. So that's, you know, that's how the problem of money was solved in the physical world. And that's how in the digital world, Bitcoin saves it. And it's exactly, you know, proof of stake is exactly like central banking. And
yes, it's the legacy system. You can also call it the legacy system, proof of stake.
And it's the exact way in which gold was corrupted and turned into governmental shitcoins was through the introduction of essentially central banking, which is a proof of stake system, which is, right, let's get all, instead of the banks just holding gold and offering receipts in gold and then allowing gold to move faster, no, let's just let the banks issue debt that is as good as gold because it is guaranteed by the central bank, and then we prevent any competitors. And therefore, and this is what, you know, this is one of the ideas that Keynes had, one of the impressively stupid ideas of John Maynard Keynes, which is, you know, look at all the wasted money and resources that go into running the gold standard. We pay people to dig under the ground to get gold out, and then we pay them to transport it and refine it, and then we transport it to banks, and then we pay people to lock it in vaults underground and lock it up. Well, you know, the Vitalik Buterin of the 19th century comes along and says, I have a better idea. We should just forget about this gold and have the banks trade their own liabilities and have the central bank guarantee those liabilities. And then you one century of death and destruction and waste and capital being wasted away, and hundreds of millions of people die because you've allowed people to just make their own money. And Bitcoin fixes this, and there's nothing the shitcoiners can do.
Yeah, I think Bitcoin fixes this in two interesting ways. Because first of all, as you said, you know, it's not physical. It's digital. It lives purely in the informational realm. That's why you can teleport it. You know, it has no mass, and that's a big advantage over gold, as you know and write about so often. And I think that's where the personal responsibility comes in, and just understanding all these things. That's where the lowering of the time preference and the personal responsibility comes in. Because once you understand, okay, we now have the same thing as gold, but in the digital realm, and it's a little bit different because it's absolutely scarce. And you can only do absolute scarcity in the digital realm. That's another thing I'm convinced about, because everything else you can just make more and mine more and so on and so forth. But the beautiful dance that Bitcoin kind of orchestrates, it will lead to 21 million. And this is non-negotiable. Like if Bitcoin increases its limit, it's a failed project. And so if it is Bitcoin, it has 21 million Bitcoins. And once you understand this, Bitcoin kind of becomes the ultimate judge. And you talk about this often as well in terms of just, you know, what else could you do to just stack more sats and earn more Bitcoin? Do I really want to go to college? Do I really want to, I don't know, buy this new car? And it's just the ultimate judge of your opportunity costs. And this is like once you understand this, it changes your life completely. You know, like that's when people start selling the chairs and and get a second job and do whatever they can to get their hands on a larger pie of the 21 million cake, because we're still in the monetization phase and we're still in the reward era. So new Bitcoin is still mined, and so it doesn't matter how hard you work. You know, 3 years from now, you will not work 10 or 20x as hard as you do now. And that's painfully obvious, I think, to every Bitcoiner. So you just try to be like, I made my peace with that a long time ago. And I just try to be as productive as I can and like consume as little as I can. And this must be enough. You know, I cannot do more. And in terms of personal responsibility, I think that's what's really fascinating, because as we all know, you know, not your keys, not your Bitcoin. And that becomes painfully obvious once you lost your keys in Mt. Gox or somewhere else. But also to really understand what you're holding, and you have to participate in the Bitcoin network. And we saw this in the block size debate. We saw this in the fork wars. We saw it now with the Taproot activation as well. And you also want to validate your incoming transactions. If you truly use Bitcoin, you want to convince yourself in a trustless manner that this is truly Bitcoin what you're holding. So to use Bitcoin properly, you also have to run your own node. And I think all of that, just holding your own keys and doing like doing a Bitcoin storage properly. And of course, you know, there are shared custodial solutions and multisig solutions, and all these problems are being solved. But I still think that it forces you kind of to take responsibility of this part of your life. And in turn, you will if you're able to do it, you will see that you actually can take on the responsibility, and this will kind of extend into other areas of your life. And I think that's why we see, you know, Bitcoiners getting more healthy, Bitcoiners starting to work out, Bitcoiners starting to change their diet, and Bitcoiners starting to raise a family and things like that.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with this entirely. And I think, you know, the connection between what we were discussing earlier about the solution of the timestamping problem and the lowering of the time preference and the personal responsibility is really direct. Like it's the solution to the mining issue and to the scarcity problem and to the time stamping problem is what allows this network to continue to operate every 10 minutes, is what, you know, keeps slapping you with the fact that, hey, it's still running every 10 minutes. There's a new slap. You know, you check your computer every day and yep, every 10 minutes, there's a new dose of reality. And then it just gets into your consciousness very deeply, the idea that this thing is there and it's going to be there and it's stable and it's reliable. And then finally, I think for us, for our generation, we finally have something that we can look at into the future and know that it's going to be there, that it's going to be stable. Because if you really think about it, this is what gold used to be for people up until the 20th century. You know, you could always save for the future because you could always buy gold, and you knew that your gold coin, you know, whatever happens, you could pass it on to your grandchildren, and they could spend it 200 years later, their great grandchildren could spend it 200 years later, and it will have still gone up in those 200 years because that was money. But then when that stopped being money, we don't have that. You know, you look all over the world, people don't have an opportunity to save. And so they don't have a way for providing for the future. And this is something I talk about in my next book, The Fiat Standard, which is available for pre-order now, as well as The Principles of Economics, which is coming in a few months. When you're able to provide for the future, you start discounting the future less. You start thinking, hey, actually, you know what? If all of this money that I'm wasting on stupid bullshit that I don't need today, if I would just collect this money over 3 years, if I'd done this over the last 3 years, today I would have had this much money. Wow, you know, this Bitcoin thing actually is reliable and it works. And it's different. You know, some people will say, well, stocks can also give you returns, but it's different. Stocks have a lot of risk, and stocks are, you know, they involve management fees and they involve judgment and selection. You need to know what you're doing. And, you know, the number go up technology in stocks is nothing like the number go up technology in Bitcoin. arguably, stocks don't keep up with inflation. If you really think about inflation in real terms, think about the house that you would ideally like to live in. You know, if money was not an issue in your town, what is the best house that you would want to live in? And then look at how much the price of that house has gone up over the last 10 years and see if your income or your stocks have managed to keep up. And the answer is almost always no, you know, unless you've... well, not almost always, but I mean, for the vast majority of people, it's no. Few people can, of course, beat it, but the majority of people cannot. And so you don't see that the things that you want in the future are attainable for you, because how do I get to them? You know, I could put the money in cash or in a saving account, it won't get there. Bonds aren't going to get there. Stocks, maybe, but it's not going to be that lucrative to tempt you to forego present consumption. I think that's the key thing. So maybe I can put it in stocks and maybe my stocks will go up, but you know, maybe they go down and in 5 years time, I'm up 10% or 15 or 20 or 50%. But in 5 years time, you know, inflation has gone up 70 or 80% because that's just what money does. You know, the house that you wanted to buy is just continuously moving out of your reach, just like the carrot hanging from a stick in front of a donkey. So no matter how hard that donkey runs, they're just not going to get the carrot. And, you know, some donkeys obviously do get the carrot, but it can be pretty exhausting for the majority of the donkeys. And so Bitcoin just allows us with this technology where you can provide for your future. And then suddenly, hey, actually, I can have that house in 3 years. I can have that thing that I want if I just, you know, save more in Bitcoin. And then suddenly you start thinking about, well, what am I going to do when I have that house in 5 years' time?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And maybe I should be healthy.
Exactly. And I think it's even more than that because, you know, like stocks are fine, I guess, but every company will go bankrupt. That's just every company will go away. And I truly believe Bitcoin will not go away. And this is the deep security that you talked about. I know Bitcoin will be there for you. I know Bitcoin will be there for me. And I was so convinced that I built my whole future around it. You know, I wouldn't have a kid now if it weren't for Bitcoin, because I knew no matter what happens, like even if my government fails me completely and my bank fails me completely or my company fails me completely or whatever, a lot of things can fail you completely. It's very unlikely that Bitcoin fails you completely. If you manage to take care of your private keys and you have a couple of Satoshis to your name, just like you can truly build a future around it and you have some security there. And this is what allowed me to just step back and allow myself to say, okay, I really want to do this. And I want to raise a family and I'm ready to become a dad. And I wouldn't have my daughter if it weren't for Bitcoin. I can very confidently say that. And it is because of the deep security that the Bitcoin network provides. I know that Bitcoin will always be there and there is nothing anyone can do about it, you know? And if I need to rely on the Bitcoin network, so be it, then it's going to be there for me.
Oh, I agree entirely. I think me starting a family very much had to do with Bitcoin. The two things came into my life at around the same time for a very good reason. As I basically submit to Bitcoin and figured out, yep, this is it. This is what it is. Immediately, like looking back right now, it's almost like there was a control knob for time preference in your mind and somebody just dropped that control knob. You know, was it 11 before they dropped it to 1? And now suddenly I started discounting the future much less. And I started thinking about, you know, the future, caring about having a family, caring about all these other things. And it makes life so much richer when you start thinking about the future, because you know what happens eventually in a few years later, the future catches up with you. And so you reap the things that you had sowed in the past. And so if once you make that shift, obviously initially it's difficult when you start saving more, you start cutting down on expenses and it can seem frustrating, but eventually, family, for instance, is another example. When, you know, having a kid can be frustrating initially. Changing a lot of filthy diapers has been a big part of my life as I've been writing the books. But it pays off in the long run. And it's the long run eventually catches up. Eventually, they get toilet trained. and they start keeping themselves busy, and then you start enjoying their company, and then you start enjoying having a family together, and it pays off. So it's a much richer way of living, because you're building things that last, you're building things that pay off into the future. And I think as you get older, as I get older, I'm beginning to realize these are the things that make the human experience important in the long run. They're not the things that you care about when you're young. When you're young, you're easily impressionable, and you're after every little flashy plastic toy out there. And then when you're older, you know, you've already tried many cars, and no matter what new gadgets they put into cars, each new car is less rewarding and less interesting than the older one. And what you're looking for are things that, you know, had required you to have invested seriously into back in your youth. And this is, I think it drives the haters crazy. For the Bitcoin haters, it drives them crazy to see this, but it's one of the very few places in the world where you see a culture of people that are concerned about the long term. It's quite striking. When you listen to Bitcoiner podcasts or you hear about conversations on Bitcoin Twitter, you know, everybody uses the term time preference like it's normal to use it. When really before Bitcoin came around, it was only just a bunch of weird Austrian economists that everybody thought was weird. And, you know, some other economists would mention it in passing. It was a mathematical term in their textbooks, but it had no significance on the real life. And now among Bitcoiners, everybody talks about time preferences if it's just a normal thing, you know, like it's the Yankees game or something.
Yeah, it's one of the things that just got memed into reality hard, you know, and now we see headlines of central bankers and other people not coming to terms with the general population just knowing what fiat means, for example. That is another term that Bitcoin has kind of made popular again. And I'm fine with not using fiat. You know, we can call them cuckbucks or shitcoins or whatever we want. That's perfectly fine as well. But I think what's so striking to me is getting to know other Bitcoiners and just seeing this experiment play out over and over and over again. You know, Bitcoiners, they lower their time preference. Once you really understand it and get into Bitcoin and your personal balance sheets, your personal balance sheet is Bitcoin mostly, you will not like spending Bitcoin is no fun. Like if you're forced to spend Bitcoin, that's not a good time. And I think also, you know, just taking care of your own finances and just taking care of your own key management, taking care of your own node, it allows you to see that, like, what you're capable of doing. And we see this over and over and over again, you know, like Bitcoiners, they start companies, they take matters into their own hands. And we see this now even, you know, like with ranches and other things, the stuff that Untapped Growth is working on and other people. And people are actually, you know, scouting for and building citadels. That's not a joke, you know, they are getting their hands on land. And this, I assume, like, if the Bitcoin thesis continues to be correct, I assume that this will, like, this community, if you want to call it that, will continue to grow. Like, there will be more sovereign individuals, and we see this also, you know, like with flag theory and just Bitcoiners trying to be mobile, getting a second citizenship, trying to get land in various areas, trying to build houses in various areas. And all of this is playing out. And I think it boils down to, as you're saying, the lowering of time preference, but also the adoption of radical responsibility. And Bitcoin shows you that nobody will come in and save you. Nobody will give you Bitcoin. You know, like you have to earn your Bitcoin. The only way to part with your Bitcoin is voluntarily. Like, someone has to offer you a service. Someone has to put in the work. You can earn Bitcoin only through proof of work. That's the only way you can do it. There is no money printer that you can get close to. There is there is no other way. There is no cheap way to acquire Bitcoin. And I think this shapes people as well. And you have to put in the work, and then you put in work in other areas as well.
Yeah, and I think the fascinating point here is that it markets itself as a cheaper solution to the problem of gold mining. But of course, and as I was quoting Keynes earlier on this, but Mises, of course, had a perfect response to this, which is that if you want to compare the cost of gold, you shouldn't compare it to the cost of running ledger entries on central bank papers and balance sheets, you should compare it to the cost of the consequences of having cheap money. And so Mises says, you know, when you compare the cost of mining gold to the cost of inflation, that's when you realize the cost of mining gold is the lesser of evils. And that's really the fiat hack. And I discussed this in detail in the fiat standard, because the fiat standard, you know, I spent years thinking about this and writing it out and fleshing it out. And you see that it's just by corrupting money and making it so that you can get money, or some people can get money without having to work for it, you've undermined the entire function of money as a saving mechanism. You've undermined people's ability to provide for the future, and you've undermined their sense of responsibility and sense of fairness and justness. And you've undermined their incentive to work hard, and you've strengthened their incentive to be, you know, dubious characters, to go around and try and find a way to print money. And so people move more and more toward this kind of world where we are looking to get closer to the printer rather than looking to be more productive. And then it's just a degradation of time preference across all aspects of life. You know, you see it in architecture, you see it in people's manners, you see it in people's mores, you see it in the way that people dress, even you see it in art, you see it in music, you see it in products, and you see in how people are just consuming heavily and constantly churning through stuff that they don't need. Because even though the stuff they don't really need, they needed more than they need their national governments depreciating fiats. And it's why really Bitcoin is the anti-fiat technology in a very real sense. It's because of proof of work and because of mining. You know, all of the fiat of the world, all of the world, and say this in the fiat standard, all of the world's governments, all of the world's religious authorities, all of the world's spiritual leaders, all of the world's scientists and academics and computer scientists and physicists and health authorities, everybody who has a self-important job in the planet, who thinks of themselves as being in a position of authority, all of those people, if they all got together, all the religions and all the governments and everybody in a self-important position anywhere in the world, if they all got together and agreed the next Bitcoin block shouldn't contain a transaction, or the next Bitcoin block should add more coins, or the next, you know, Bitcoin block should not come at all, they can just simply do what the Bitcoiners always recommend, which is cry harder. You can't stop it. People will find a way to mine the block, and the block will come, and they will find a way of adding their transactions to it, and it'll continue to operate. So yeah. It's powerful, searing truth that just comes to the world and forces everybody to reckon with it. And it's amazing. Yeah,
absolutely. And I think most people, especially most legislators, have not understood some basic facts about Bitcoin. Because when we think about mining, we think about, plugging in ASICs. But it's just the nature of mining is just finding a large random number. You can do it on pen and paper. It's very inefficient and you will never find a valid block in time. But there is no magic sauce happening in mining. You know, like even outlawing mining is a very weird concept, because you in essence outlaw math and outlaw numbers. And for mining as well, I mean, we see this now in China, you know, like there's some Rouge mining operations have been going on still, even after the ban, with, you know, trucks full of ASICs running, driving around with, like, finding the next power outlet and having a satellite connection somewhere, somehow. And this is all you really need for mining. I think that's what most people still underestimate. You only need a communication channel and some energy you can't tap into. And I think just in Bitcoin in general, and I hope to write about this in the coming weeks, it's very hard for me to make any sense of the world if the world outlaws Bitcoin, and if legislators come together and say, you know, you cannot do certain math operations, you cannot have 12 words in your head. And when it comes down to it, that's all that Bitcoin is. Bitcoin is just numbers, and Bitcoin, you can have Bitcoin in your head. And I think that's also, you spoke about how gold was in the end centralized. And I think the unconfiscatable nature of Bitcoin, if you secure it properly, this is still like very underappreciated, because the fact is that governments and powerful people cannot step in and take your Bitcoin. If you secure them properly, they have to torture you, you know? And it doesn't matter if you use a sophisticated multi-signature setup or if you have a password in your head or even your private keys in your head. Like in the end, they have to torture you. So there is no way to forcefully take your Bitcoin if you secure them properly. And this is something that we never had before. Like everything that exists in the physical world can be taken away from you. So this is such a novel concept that I think most people that make the laws, they just haven't wrestled with this fact yet. And I think we will see some interesting legal cases where they have the person. And I think we already saw that, you know, there are some forced hodls and some interesting stories. But you might be able to shut down the operation and you might be able to imprison the person, but you won't be able to get the Bitcoin. And I think that's an interesting fact of this thing.
Yeah, it's absolutely amazing. I think fiat people are going to, I think, keep in mind the fact that, you know, the Bitcoin early adopters have had their minds blown, but they are almost certainly the people that are most likely to have had this realization. So either you came at it from a libertarian perspective or from a from an Austrian economics perspective, or as a software engineer, you have a kind of inkling about how powerful software can be. So as much as it blows all of our minds, I think we are still the people that are going to have their minds blown the least by the implications of this. You know, there are people out there who think their government creates reality. They really do exist. They think life is all about you vote for the best people and then the best people create the reality that you want. And anything in this reality that you don't like is because of the evil bastards in power. And it's only about finding the right bastards to put in power so that they can then create the reality that I want. Imagine how those people are going to come to terms with Bitcoin.
I think we already see this, you know, I think we already, we saw it in the last couple of years, and I think we're going to see it with increasing intensity. And there is a nice term for it, which is called Bitcoin derangement syndrome. And it can take many shapes and forms. And if you are raised on a fiat mindset and all your life you've been plugged in into the fiat matrix, you will have a very hard time. And I think there are some people that are just not flexible enough mentally to accept the reality that Bitcoin represents, and they are gonna lose their mind. We've seen it already. Like there are some people that legit went crazy and did not come back. And I think this will continue to happen. And I also think Bitcoiners are not immune. I think some Bitcoiners they turned crazy as well and had some very weird ideas or just got bitten too hard or took too many orange pills, phrase it however you want. But it's like Bitcoin has the tendency to drive people mad. It can definitely do that.
Absolutely. I think we see it with a lot of the Bitcoin haters. Like you look at people like Nouriel Roubini, Peter Schiff. Well, Peter Schiff, maybe not. I think Peter Schiff probably still has his mind. He's just shilling his own business. And if you think of what Peter Schiff does as marketing for his fund, you know, it's enormously successful, because the alternative is he would be just one of the many gold funds that have been performing terribly over the last 10 years, but he gets his name out. So maybe I think Peter Schiff is a bad example, but I think Nouriel Roubini is a great example. I think the most powerful example this year has been Nassim Nicholas Taleb, who has just completely lost his mind. I mean, it's not even funny what he's doing at this point. And I think in his case in particular, I think it's, you know, probably some of it is to do with me. But I think the more that I think about it, I'm beginning to see it outside of the context of, I'm beginning to get a little bit less convinced that it is about me and it's more just about Bitcoin. In particular, it's about what has happened in Lebanon and Bitcoin, because he's coming to the realization, you know, he was completely blind to this possibility, even though I spent like 6 years trying to talk this into him, but he's just a complete idiot who won't listen to anything new. And I was just trying to explain to him, you know, how Bitcoin works and how useful it is for people whose governments are ruining their lives with inflation. And then 2019 comes about and the lira begins to collapse, and I'm there and I'm constantly trying to explain to him, you know, you should tell people to use Bitcoin. I'm not Lebanese, and I just left Lebanon. I don't know many people there, and I'm not well connected. So I don't have anywhere near the kind of audience that he would get in Lebanon. But he could have made a huge difference. You know, in 2019, he was going around talking about how, you know, how reform can work and how we can fix this. And he was calling for capital controls. And he was saying, you know, the lira is fine. There's not going to be a big collapse. So then you think about him standing. And you know, in retrospect, the reason is he's good buddies with the people who are in power in Lebanon right now. And so, you know, he likes to think of himself as being the hero that is helping out the poor people. But really, he was looking out for his buddies in power because, you know, you're telling people to continue to use the lira and you're telling people that a capital controls where we stop you from accessing your money is actually for your own good. And you don't tell people about Bitcoin and you don't tell them that Bitcoin is the solution. And then the lira goes on to lose 95% of its value over 2 years. It's compared to the US dollar, while Bitcoin does about 5x over those 2 years. It goes up by fivefold over those 2 years. So you can imagine just how shocking this would be. I mean, essentially what he's been going through is the vicious lashing out at everything around him to prevent that reality from manifesting in his mind, to prevent that realization from happening. You know, it's just, if I keep shouting hard enough and if I keep blocking those Bitcoiners on Twitter, if I keep calling Bitcoin stupid, and if I go on CNBC and tell the world that Bitcoin is stupid, and if I write the Bitcoin black paper that I argue that Bitcoin is going to go to zero, I could get Bitcoin to go down to zero before I have to think about the possibility that maybe I was wrong. Before I have to think about that, shit, maybe actually if in 2019 or 2018 or 17 or 16 or 15 or 14, if I'd, you know, taken an orange pill and learned to learn humbly, if I hadn't just dismissed this thing as, oh, well, you know, Saif is talking about this thing and it's a bunch of nerds on the internet and I'm going to write an intro to Saif's book, but I'm not going to even read the book and I'm not going to even know anything about Bitcoin. But, you know, I'm Nassim Taleb and I'm very smart and I can figure out things. And I'm just going to get this free option on Bitcoin. If this Bitcoin thing works out and Saif is right, then, you know, my name is out there on the book and I'll get the credit for it. And I can say that I thought it was a good idea. And if it doesn't work out, so who cares? In both cases, you know, he's not doing any effort. He's getting off being lazy, zero proof of work, fiat mindset. And he's going to collect the rewards from that. And then, of course, the opposite happens, which is that Bitcoin doesn't fall apart. Bitcoin keeps succeeding. And it turns out that, you know, maybe you should have actually paid attention to it. Maybe you should have read the book. Maybe you could have gotten a lot of people's lives fixed if they could put a part of their savings in Bitcoin. You know, back then in 2019, I mean, this was when the banks were insolvent and they stopped offering dollars and the price of the dollar started to go up in the black market. Like, if you've known monetary history, you know that this never resolves itself except in one way. Number go down. You know, the value of the currency is going down. There's obviously far more liabilities for dollars in the country than there are dollars. And a lot of people are holding on to liras that they expect to have more purchasing power. And so this thing is going to resolve. So I think we're going to see so much of this. And I think Lebanon is kind of an interesting case study as a kind of prequel for what's going to take place in more and more of the world as people's minds break because, shit, this thing was actually there all along, but I was laughing at it like a fucking idiot on the internet.
but that's why it's so hard. That's why it's so hard. Like, it's, I think you hit the nail on the head when you said he lacked the humility to admit that he was wrong. But Bitcoin makes this especially hard. I mean, it's very hard to step up and say, okay, I was wrong about this. I changed my mind. You guys were right. About any topic, this is really hard. It takes a lot of character to do this. It takes a lot of character to admit that you were fooled, that you were wrong, that your understanding was lacking, whatever. Especially if you're a credentialed and smart person. But Bitcoin makes this, depending on your time frame, 100x as hard. Because of you missed out. You know, you could be rich, you could be a multimillionaire. You are not only wrong, but you're wrong and poor as well now. And so this is what Bitcoin does to you. And I think this is why he's such a great case study as well, because we will see this over and over and over again. And then you have to use your grand intellect to tell everyone that it's not you that was wrong, everyone else is still wrong, and Bitcoin will go to zero and it's just tulips and so on and so forth. And that's also why no naysayer, like no coiner will ever name a price. Like, at what price do you admit defeat? No one will ever.
This is my criteria. This is why I'll never take any no coiner who doesn't name a price as being serious. Because if you know, there is a price at which Bitcoin is bigger than the entire global bond market. There's a price at which Bitcoin puts bonds out of business, where nobody buys bonds anymore. That's it. We don't have a bond market anymore. So if everybody in the world dumps all of their bonds and buys Bitcoin, and then a Bitcoin is at, say, $10 million a coin, would you still think it's going to zero and everybody's bonds are going to zero? If you answer yes, you're a fucking moron and you're not worth talking to. You're not worth the attention to. And this is the question that I asked for Hanke, and he kind of had the decency to not answer yes. He said, well, blah, 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 made a bunch of noises. But then essentially it didn't break through. It didn't get into his head. He still just, he refuses to let that fact come into his mind. And he just continues to say, well, yeah, speculative goes to zero. I will add, though, that in the case of Taleb, there is another reason that in why I think his particular case of Bitcoin derangement syndrome is just so nasty, which is his entire career was made out of the fact that he basically never made a public call and never had skin in the game on anything. And all he does is just call out people for that. And so he looks at, you know, he fishes for any person on Wall Street who made a mistake and had a bad quarter, and then goes after them and unleashes his internet bullies at him, and essentially portrays this guy as, you know, the root of all evil, or the personification of evil, because look at this evil Wall Street person who's taken a lot of money from clients, and then he put it into this thing which didn't work, and he lost money, and, you know, he's a failure, he's a liar, he's a fraud. And that's what he's been doing for his entire career, essentially, without ever sharing any of his own calls. So he's never shared a public track record of his own trading. So we have no idea if he's actually a good trader or a bad trader. And I think, you know, the fact that he doesn't share his track record suggests more likely that he's a bad trader. So it was a very comfortable gig that he had for him, because he had such a big cult of people around him on the internet that could go and bully anybody. You couldn't even hear anybody ask him back, you know, well, why don't you show us how well you did in the last quarter? But Bitcoin ended up being the one call that he did make, ended up being the one public call where he actually now has skin in the game. You know, he's never been in that position. He's always out, you know, he's always like the football fan who shows up when the game is over and says, that coach is an idiot. He shouldn't have played this guy. He should have played that guy. And he should have went with four defenders instead of five defenders and man-marked Lionel Messi, and then he would have won the World Cup. You know, it's very easy for you as a football fan to come up with a Monday morning quarterbacking, and that, you know, a lot of TV analysts make their job like this. But ultimately, the best TV analysts are the ones who have worked in this job and have had their chops proven. You know, they went to the World Cup, they won the World Cup, they made the semifinal. They don't have to have won the World Cup, but, you know, they made the semifinal, which is a huge deal. They won a Champions League. They have the experience and the track record that shows that they know what it takes. But the opinions of fans are endless. And he managed to always portray himself as the as essentially being on a par with the managers while sitting with the fans, without actually making any call, without ever without ever having a team selection actually take to the field. You know, he never had to pick 11 millionaire players and manage them and make sure that they're all happy with their wives and girlfriends, and that they all like each other, and they all pass the ball to each other, and that they all train properly and eat properly. and, you know, then have to pick all the formation. He never had to do that. So he can always waltz in and say, yeah, you did the mistake, because there's always a loser. You know, somebody's going to have to lose. We always have to have a winner and a loser. And somebody's going to make a bad trade. Although, you know, with monetary policy these days, it's very, very hard to lose a trade. But he's managed to just basically do that. And it's, you know, it's fascinating how Bitcoin is just the you know, what's that flower that catches the insects? What is it called?
Venus flytrap.
Yes, the Venus. Yeah, it's like that for for liars, essentially, and for hucksters, because it is just an endless black hole of truth. And if you come near it, you will be drawn into its vortex, and you will either submit to truth and be honest, or you will just very, very, very obviously be exposed, because it's a very simple thing. It does one block every 10 minutes, and it has a set of balances. And all of your noise won't buy you one Satoshi on the next block. And if you don't have a Satoshi on the next block, who cares about your opinion? And every time you express an opinion without buying a Satoshi on the block, you're being an idiot. And I'm sorry, because there's no other way of putting it, because, you know, if you have an opinion on this, it doesn't matter. It doesn't move anything. You're just wasting energy. Literally, you know, opining on Bitcoin without buying Bitcoin is wasting energy, because you could have just put that energy into Bitcoin. You know, you could have washed dishes during that time, made some money, put it into Bitcoin, and then you would have been on the network, and then you would have counted for something in your life. Choosing to be off it and then having opinions about it is just an amazing trap. To watch, you know, Nouriel Roubini has been calling Bitcoin a scam since $58. Since Bitcoin was at 58. So he's done 1,000x. He could have become, you know, he could have done a lot in his life if he just taken the humble position of, let's put $10 on this every week, just in case I'm wrong. He would have had a very lucrative insurance policy against him being wrong. But you see that it's not rational, and it's not self-interested. And most importantly, it's very short-sighted. It's fiat people. They don't think in the long run. Well, what if you were wrong? Well, if you're wrong, not only have you destroyed your reputation, but also you've destroyed, you know, your job is going to be destroyed. Your fiat career of working for parasitic institutions like the IMF is going to be hopeless. Your university is likely to be hopeless. So it's a very big risk that you're taking with no potential upside. You know, the potential upside is if Bitcoin dies and then everybody forgets about Bitcoin, you get to go around saying, hey, I'm the one who...
I told you so. Yeah, it's an interesting phenomenon, and it's especially interesting that the person that said, you know, don't tell me what you think, show me your portfolio, never showed his portfolio, and just, you know, portfolio is always out of the question. And it's just I'm becoming more and more, like, I see more and more the benefit of just ignoring all this noise, because in the end, you know, if you truly think the Bitcoin will go to zero, just be my guest and short it. There are many people like me that no matter what value I produce, most of it will land in Bitcoin. So just my buy pressure alone, and just the insane buy pressure of Bitcoiners all around the world will make sure that your shorts will get killed.
I think, and, you know, the... sorry, go ahead.
And I think that's also what a lot of people kind of underestimate, coming from the fiat and mainstream media world. They don't see, like they don't know the momentum that is behind this thing. You know, the people that are actually building, the people that are putting their whole life energy into it, the people that truly want to see this succeed and will do everything to make it succeed, kind of. And it's also, you know, like I'm prepared for whatever comes. Like if Bitcoin dies and goes to zero tomorrow, I'll be fine. You know, I have a certain skill set. I'll be useful no matter what. I don't believe that this is highly likely, but it's not like it's, because I think the mainstream media often portrays it, you know, there are some crazy internet people and some weird, you know, online drug people that sit on the couch and speculate on funny internet money. That is not the case at all. We are building the Bitcoin standard for our kids and for our grandkids. And we are building things that are going to last long into the future. And there's some proper engineering and some proper blood, sweat, and tears, tears put into this. And this is also, I believe, why it's going to work. Like, there are amazing people working on Bitcoin, and just it's evolving all the time. And I'm constantly blown away by the innovation that is happening in and on top of Bitcoin. And we haven't seen anything yet, you know. Like, I truly believe this is like pretty, like, to say, the dawn of the Bitcoin Renaissance. I think we haven't even started yet. The things that are currently built on top of Bitcoin and the things that are enabled by Bitcoin are so amazing that we will look back on this era, like 10, 15 years from now, and it will be very hard to believe, I think.
Yeah, I think if you're blown away now, you know, wait until you see what's going to happen to the world that's built by second generation Bitcoiners. You know, people who grew up learning about these ideas from their parents when they were kids and had their mind free from a lot of the fiat brainwashing bullshit of imagining that the world is built by fiat. But I want to go back to one point you made about your own buying pressure. I think this is a point I should be making more often, but I don't make more often, which is that Bitcoin really only needs for the new marginal demand every day to, in order for a number to go up, in order for the price of Bitcoin to go up, you want the new marginal demand to not drop by 50% every 4 years. So 4 years from now, if the marginal demand on the day, you know, on the day equivalent to today, 4 years from now, if the amount of new buying is roughly equal to the amount of new buying that we have today, then the price is going to be higher. If the amount is equal to half of the amount that we have today, because there's going to be a halving from now until 4 years from now, and so the number of Bitcoin that's going to be produced 4 years from today is always going to be half of the number of Bitcoin that we have now. So as long as new Bitcoin demand doesn't drop below 50% of what it is, of what it was 4 years ago, number go up. That's why we've never seen the Bitcoin price go down over a horizon of 4 years, because over a horizon of 4 years, you're going from a place where you have X Bitcoin being produced every day to X over 2 Bitcoin being produced every day. And so it's never happened. There's never been a period of time that had a Bitcoin price lower than the price 4 years ago. That has never happened, because the marginal production on those two dates is always 50% less in the later dates. So it's, you know, you, this is, I think, what drives the Bitcoin, the no coiners mad, which is, yeah, you can shout and scream until you're blue in the face, but, and even if you convince a lot of Bitcoiners to stop buying in, you need 4 years. You need to make them drop by more than 50% over 4 years in order for the price to stop going up and for the network to continue to grow. So good luck with that, you know. And you're talking about people who have already witnessed a lot of gains and a lot of improvements in their life from Bitcoin. So they're highly, highly happy with the experience. You know, the vast majority of Bitcoins, if there was a website where you could rate Bitcoin, you would give it 5 stars. The vast majority of Bitcoiners have had a 5-star experience with Bitcoin, and they're going to be repeat customers. They're going to come back every time they have a bunch of fiat they don't need for the next few months or for the next few years. They're going to stack sats with it.
Yeah.
It's going to take an enormous, enormous effort from people like Rubini and Talib to be able to bring that demand down by more than 50%. But, you know, they should definitely keep trying. And I definitely urge them to keep trying to cry harder and harder, because surely one day crying hard will solve this.
I think it's even kind of worse than that, because Bitcoiners are also highly motivated, and just having experienced the power of Bitcoin firsthand, and I mean especially, you know, the censorship resistant properties and the possibility that you can earn money no matter where you are, you know, like, it's you can receive Bitcoin no problem, and if you can render useful services online, you will get paid and you will be able to make money. And if you, I don't want to go back to another world where I need to, you know, give up a blood sample and a DNA sample to be allowed to have a bank account and things like that. And I think Bitcoiners are highly motivated also, you know, to switch jurisdictions, to start companies somewhere else. They're highly mobile. They they will become more wealthy and more powerful as time moves on if the Bitcoin thesis continues to be correct. And I think people just underestimate what they're dealing with here. And the world is a big place and Bitcoins are all around the world. So in the Bitcoin sphere, we also have a very US-centric view of the world. But Bitcoin is way bigger than that. Bitcoin is way bigger than Bitcoin Twitter. You know, like I always like to joke, Bitcoin Twitter is like 200 people. And that's not too far from the truth. But there are people, you know, as we've seen now in China and also in some other places in the world, you never see them online. They don't appear on podcasts. They don't talk with the religious people online. They just do their thing and they like Bitcoin because of the things it enables. And they like Bitcoin because it's hard censorship resistant money. And they like Bitcoin because it's insanely useful and it's freedom enabled. And all these properties, I think, make Bitcoin far superior than all the alternatives. And I think Bitcoiners don't want to miss it for that alone. And if we have to, you know, if some Bitcoiners have to get into politics, like CoinDesk and other people are working on that to, you know, make Bitcoin friendly jurisdictions a thing, then so be it. And we now see the fruits of this labor. You know, we see Texas, we see Miami, we see other places where Bitcoiners and Bitcoin companies are invited because those people that make these legislations, they know that Bitcoiners will bring talent, will bring money, and will bring other resources. And I think we are going to see this thesis play out now. And it's I just think most fiat people don't know what they're dealing with with yet.
Yeah, but I think, you know, we should definitely encourage them to keep crying harder. Maybe it'll work. Maybe that'll convince Bitcoiners to stop.
That,
so
that always works. Cry harder and have fun staying poor.
Exactly. All right, I have one more question about the SHA-256 algorithm. You've written about that and about just how secure it is. You've written quite eloquently about it. Could you give us a little rundown of why the SHA-256 works?
Yeah, so that's strong cryptography in general, but the numbers in Bitcoin, they are so large, like our brains cannot make sense of how large those numbers are. And as one of the chapters in my book, 21 Lessons, is called Strength in Numbers. And Bitcoin's security, Bitcoin's strength truly lies in these insanely large numbers. And it's, for example, your private key is just a random number. And the security of your private key stems from the fact that you cannot go from the public key to the private key. You would have to brute force guess the private key. And because it's such a large number, you would, even if you build a perfect computer that, you know, only uses one quantum of energy to flip a bit, and you build a Dyson sphere around the sun, and you let this computer guess this number for, you know, 5 million years, you still have, like, you know, a 0.1% chance only to find this number. I'm making these numbers up now, but the point is that even with a perfect computer that we cannot build yet, you know, like our computers are good, but they are far, far from perfect. And even if you consume the energy of a whole sun to do computations, those numbers are so large, just crunching the numbers, just counting up to the number that is your private key, is it will take until the heat death of the universe or until the star explodes, at least, you know, like it's insane. And the same is true for all security in Bitcoin, like SHA-256, same principle. Like the numbers are just so insanely large, you're basically trying to find a needle in a haystack. And to be able to find this needle, that the amount of computation you have to go through, it absolutely boggles the mind.
Yeah, it's an amazing thing. It's, you know, I only really understood Bitcoin and thought that Bitcoin could work once I, you know, got over my laziness and my technical incompetence and decided to shut up and try and understand those things. And obviously, I don't claim to be an expert on these issues, and I don't write about them because I've not studied them at a professional level where I feel comfortable explaining and writing about these things extensively. I mean, I write about them in the Bitcoin Standard as a way of sort of communicating the essence of how they work. But it's really important, I think, for a Bitcoiner to just buckle down for a few weeks and read about this stuff, read just how it works. You know, even if you're not going to end up working on it, even if you're not going to become a software engineer, just understand the basics of how it works so that you can understand why it works, because why it is reliable. And I think it's figuring out just the magnitude of the numbers involved and the odds of guessing the right number or guessing the private key correctly is an essential part of understanding the Bitcoin value proposition in my mind.
Yeah, absolutely. And it just goes to show also that Bitcoin security does not rely on some obscure mathematical trick or anything like that. It relies on the base reality of our universe. You know, like we know that to count numbers, you need to flip bits. And even if you could flip bits perfectly and use all the energy of the sun, it just still wouldn't help because it just would take too long. You know, like it would take you millions of years still. And that's how big those numbers are. That's how good Bitcoin security is.
Yeah. All right. Well, Peter has a question for you. Peter, you want to go ahead?
Yeah, thanks, Saïd. So, and thanks, Guy. It was a really interesting discussion. I really enjoyed listening to this. I had a question about the risks to Bitcoin in general, because obviously in this conversation, we're talking with quite a high degree of confidence about the future of Bitcoin. And you were saying earlier that all companies eventually are going to go bankrupt, but you think that Bitcoin will continue to function, you know, well into the future. So I wanted to ask whether you, like, what your number one risk would be that you'd highlight to Bitcoin succeeding. Is there something that kind of keeps you up at night in terms of thinking about maybe it's from a sort of engineering perspective that you think there might be some sort of problem with a Bitcoin network, or maybe it's from a kind of state perspective, states acting against Bitcoin in some way that could make it very difficult for users. What would you say is the biggest risk that Bitcoin faces at the moment?
Great question. I don't have anything that really keeps me up at night, but I think the biggest risk is still social and political. Just, you know, Bitcoiners are the enemy. Bitcoin is terribly bad and we have to outlaw it and just make it insanely difficult to use Bitcoin. And I think the biggest risk is that the same thing happens to Bitcoin what happened to the internet and to the open internet in particular. The internet was captured by Google, Amazon, Facebook, and some others. And I think if we are not careful and if we don't if we don't focus on the core value proposition of Bitcoin and the responsibility that adopting a Bitcoin standard entails, which is to hold your own keys and run your own node, then the same thing can happen. You know, if everyone only uses Coinbase and nothing else exists, it's very similar to a situation in some countries, but in large parts of the world, only Facebook exists, you know, only Google exists. The people don't know about the internet or the open internet. And I think we could end up in a similar situation. And of course, what this would entail is all kinds of fractional reserve banking, other things. And as I've said before, you know, like if you only have one node in the whole network, then you basically, again, have a server-client relationship, not a flat network structure.
Yeah, thank you.
Anybody else have any other questions?
I actually have an add-on to this. I wrote about this in my book as well. Bitcoin is not completely trustless. It's trust minimized all across the board where it can be. So there are still quote-unquote attack vectors in Bitcoin. For example, the elliptic curve cryptography that Bitcoin currently uses, it could have a mathematical backdoor in theory, you know? Like there are those very strange things that we just don't know about. You can think about this as a software product that has a zero-day exploit. It's just a bug in the software, a bug in an encryption scheme, whatever, that no one knows about. And you could make use of that to attack the system. It's highly, highly, highly unlikely. But this is, you know, like you cannot know what you do not know. So there are always some things, some mathematical or even physical breakthroughs that could undermine some of the core principles of Bitcoin. Just, you know, if we would have free energy, free computation, that's as I mentioned before, one of the core axioms of Bitcoin is that computation needs energy. If that doesn't hold, then Bitcoin falls apart. The same is true for mathematical assumptions. P does not equal NP. Like we assume in Bitcoin that some of the problems that the mathematical problems that Bitcoin is built up around, we assume that they are very easy to verify if you have a correct solution, but very hard to find these solutions. So it's one of the millennium problems in mathematics if those two complexity classes are equal or not. So this is still unknown. There is no mathematical proof that proves that B, that P does not equal NP. And if this does not hold, all encryption goes out the window. You know, like everything that we've built around in the in the realm of information, everything that computers do basically will stop to work. And so there are those kind of things. But again, I have nothing that keeps me up at night. I think it is possible to understand Bitcoin from first principles. And also keep in mind that only one part of Bitcoin is technology. You know, Bitcoin is also biology. And I think that's where the attack vector is larger.
Yeah. Ultimately, all engineering is social engineering at the end of the day, because it's all for humans.
That is true.
Okay. Well, Gigi, thank you so much for joining us. This has been absolutely fascinating. And where can people find out more about you and your work? Tell us more about your websites and stuff.
I think the easiest way is just to follow me on Twitter at DerGigi, and you can read my shit posts and just gather basically zero insights on on there, but maybe have some fun along with some other Bitcoiners. I also have a website, DerGigi.com, where I post all my writing. I try to stay away from Medium and other publication mediums nowadays. I try to self-host as much as I can. And you can read my book for free online on 21lessons.com. And you can, of course, buy it as well. But all of my stuff is released under a Creative Commons license. So you can modify it, translate it, remix it. And people actually do. So this was one of the best decisions I ever made. You know, there are now virtual reality worlds where you can read the audiobook of 21 lessons while hopping like a rabbit through some tunnels with your friends. So I think all of that is amazing. Thanks to everyone who worked on that.
Yeah, and I should add, one of your best articles is a letter to friends and family who I think the title is Letters to Friends and Family Who Don't Have Bitcoin or Who Haven't Discovered Bitcoin or something like that.
Yeah, dear family, dear friends, a letter to all that still don't have any Bitcoin or something like
yes.
that. It was translated to, I think, almost 15 languages now, and it resonated with a lot of people. I just tried to distill it down to what the Bitcoiners are preaching, you know, just buy small amounts regularly. Don't try to trade this thing. You know, everyone, like trading will just hurt you. Stay away from shitcoins and just have a very long time horizon and hold your own keys.
Yeah, I should have mentioned maybe earlier, but in my website, safedean.com, there's an Arabic page where I translated, where I have my book available for free download in Arabic, as well as a bunch of articles that I chose. And that was one of the articles that I chose, and I got translators to translate it to Arabic, and it's posted on the website. So thank you for writing that, and thank you again for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, and thank you also for translating the article and including it. It's amazing.
Cheers. All right, have a good day.
Bye-bye.